RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
All right, let's have our political panel for a Friday morning here at RCR. Welcome in, Matt Robson. Hi, Matt.
Greetings.
He was just waving here for a moment. I was hoping he was going to say something. Yeah, Tanakwe. Annie O'Brien. Hi, Annie.
Tanakwe. Well, we can all do it this morning and make sure that we don't upset the Labor Party by using the wrong hello.
We're not in the South Island now, you know.
Dr. Ropata.
I can say that because that's where I am. And you know who? Mr. Slater. Hey, Cam.
Paul of the Naka.
I thought we could start on sledging, you know?
It's a lost art, isn't it? I mean,
yeah, it is.
Some fantastic sledges. I mean, I remember back in my day in the old Eden Electorate, Matt might remember a few of the old argy bargies that went on in Eden Electorate back in the day. You went along to political meetings to hone your skills at political sledging, and it seems to have disappeared. And now people are taking great umbrage or thinking things are offensive. And in the latest episode, of course, is yesterday, well, I think it was Wednesday, actually, where the opposition was attacking Willie Jackson and Chris Hipkins were attacking Paul Goldsmith for writing a letter to the Australian ambassador and crossing out Tanakwe and all the other mumbo jumbo at the end and putting yours sincerely good afternoon or whatever it was that he put in there. And they said, this is a terrible, it's an affront, it's an insult, blah, blah, blah. And Christopher Luxon said, well, you know, in my experience in dealing with Australians, you've got to speak slowly and make it easy for them to understand. And, of course, they've taken great umbrage at that, gone and contacted Bo in Australia, and he's come back and said, well, you know, the Kiwi accent's pretty hard too, and we need translators sometimes. So the politicians are playing it properly. It looks like the media and maybe some of the opposition are getting a bit precious.
Who is really good?
That's the trend, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, look at Todd McClay, you know, apparently got in trouble for riffing off the old Shortland Street thing about, you know, you're not in Guatemala now, Dr. Ropata, by saying to Ricardo Menendez March, you're not in Mexico now. And, you know, apparently people were offended by that. But you know, the rest of the country is probably laughing and thinking, good on you, Todd.
Yeah, I think with the sledging thing, you sometimes have to pull it apart. It's like in sport, you know, really great in cricket, you know, at the sledging. Some of it is not clever. Some of it is just abusive. And so you can pull it apart and see whether it is or not. The question of humour is the other thing. If I was Ricardo, I would have just said something smart back, you know, because it would have just been byplay then. Mm. The thing you said about you're not in Guatemala now, Dr. Ropata, was a great line, and you can use it again. And Ricardo should have shot. I hadn't thought about what he should have shot back, but he should have shot something back. It's your point about you learn in politics to sledge in a correct way. Now, Winston Peters, who I have no great love for, actually does well when he's by just smiling. And it's not because he might be to be totally offensive. The person might have been quite correct in taking him on, but he shows us that's the best way to often handle it. And so, yeah, I agree that bring it down. The Tanakwe thing, well, you know, yeah, I can understand. You don't write to inside New Zealand, people know what it means. It's the same as if you say bonjour, good état. Yeah, but outside of that, of course, it doesn't mean anything to anybody. So,
what was the Muldoon one back in the day?
No, is it if a New Zealander leaves to go to Australia, they improve the IQ of both countries?
That's the one.
Yeah.
IQ, I think he said.
Yeah. And
being Australian born, I had that given to me many times. Just as minister, I was told that I was appropriate to be the Minister of Corrections, and I used to point out that I actually disproved this theorem because I'd been sent, like Superman from Krypton to assist the Earth. I'd been sent from Australia as a young baby to assist New Zealanders, and I thought extremely good job. And I was following in the footsteps of the first Labor cabinet, which had half of them, I believe, up to half, Savage being one, but Harry Holland before him, and then Semple, all Australians. Whereas New Zealand, okay, Dalkey Peterson to my home state of Queensland, who wasn't universally thought of as the greatest genius in the world. Anyway.
But, you know, Muldoon was great at sledging. I mean, I can recall one where they were deciding on the Anzac frigates, and I don't know if you might have been in Parliament at that time, Matt.
No, but, not when. No.
Yeah, when they decided to get the Anzac frigates, of course, Muldoon wasn't in power then. He was just a backbench MP. But he was on the select committee, and they had this Australian admiral come over to explain why we should buy the Australian frigates. And he, you know, had this complicated, you know, presentation with PowerPoints and said, of course, you know, the reason why we need to buy these Australian frigates as opposed to a Northern Hemisphere frigate is because of the different oscillation of the waves. And Muldoon said, excuse me, Captain. He said, oh, it's Admiral Sir Robert. He said, yes, Captain. Are you telling me that Abel Tasman and James Cook sailed down here in the wrong effing ships?
Okay. Mind you, that is something on Cook Strait. That's why the ferries were a particular length. But anyway, to say.
They just run them on the beach these days.
The rocks. The rocks. You've got to be accurate. Matt, I think you can have first go. Reasons why selling part of Kiwi Bank could do more harm than good.
Okay. First thing I'd say is it's a debate, you know. And once again, what I often say is that what we lack in New Zealand is having a good debate. Everybody puts up their facts and you draw different conclusions. And so clearly on the question of banking, people are interested in what comes. People got their different opinions. But I'll just point this out, that in terms of development, that one area that New Zealand needs to start looking at, it's off this topic, but I'm coming up later on in a debate in this in a couple of weeks' time,
okay,
is the question of BRICS. And the BRICS countries are now 35% of the world's GDP, and the G7 is, I think, about 35%. The G7 is 31. So whether people like the BRICS or like the G7 or what have got opinions on it, it's a fact that there's this huge difference now growing between the BRICS countries and the G7. So you need to take that into account when you're looking at the world. Each of those key BRIC countries have state banks, and they have state banks under the control of their governments, completely government-owned. They use them for development. None of that is to say that you agree with all different countries. India is one of them. China's another. Russia's another. South Africa and Brazil all got different political systems, different issues, etc. But one thing they have in common is that they hold on to that state bank. And New Zealand, too, in terms of its development, being a country that was short of capital, in particularly the 19th century and the early 20th century, the state bank played an extremely big role in being able to develop the country and the infrastructure. So my opinion is that, one, first of all, there hasn't been a debate. And if there is a proposal to privatise the Kiwi Bank, which I'm against, obviously, then I really want the members of Parliament to, even if they're for the privatisation, to go through the arguments, the statistical factors, and put in front of the whole population the for and the against, so people can really think about it. If it's just an emotional plea to let mum and dad investor pay part of the Kiwi Bank, then the other side of it should be down. Mum and dad investor are soon bought out by the big investors on the banks. Yeah. And it's just a ploy. So you might want to do it, but don't feed us that this line is for mum and dad. Just the last thing, because I was involved with setting up the Kiwi Bank, so clearly I've got a commitment to it. For the reasons that I'm saying, I actually believe it's an important tool in a government's toolbox for economic and sustainable development. But the name, it doesn't have to call it, it was called the Kiwi Bank. Actually, just, you know, because that undercut a whole lot of opposition to it. And also it allowed Jim Bulger to come in, which was, I wasn't involved, but that was Michael Cullen's idea.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. The National Party just shut up and Jim Bulger became the first chair. The cool thing about the Kiwi Bank is not that it's Kiwi owned, it's privately owned. It's a public bank. And that's the question to debate. So, yes, I've probably said enough now. I'm for it. I want the debate to open. Maybe some of the things we say here will help
I think a key point you made there, which I think is true of so many things now, is that if we were to take a look at this, it'd be a massive, significant step. And so a public conversation would be vital. Now, as things are right now, likely one side would call the other side pack of commies, and the other side would call, say, you know, dirty, evil capitalists. And it would be a mudslugging, just like any other topic we're dealing with right now. And so I think the challenge for us is when we approach big topics like this, or where there is some emotional attachment and as well as just factual arguments, we need to learn how to have those conversations again, where we can have a discussion and put forward our argument. You know, I'm persuadable on this issue. If whoever makes the best argument, I'll go with them. I'm not wedded to it. And I think a lot of Kiwis are like that on many issues, but they can't be persuaded, because all it turns into is commies versus capitalists, Māori versus non-Māori, women versus men. You know, like, it's just always this fight.
I agree with both of you. There needs to be a discussion about whether or not a government should own a bank or not. In New Zealand, owning banks has been fraught with danger. We only have to think about the BNZ crisis, you know, kind of caused by Muldoon, but a crisis nonetheless that needed, you know, bailing out. There's also a belief, you know, somehow around the world that these banks are too big to fail and therefore we bail them out. You know, Kiwi Bank was a reasonable idea, one of the few good ones that Jim Anderton had. There's a few. You know, every politician has a few good ideas. The way it was set up, it meant that it was always going to be undercapitalized. Yes, it had the government owning it, the reality is it was undercapitalized, and it continues to be undercapitalized, and it's fighting against massive big Australian banks, which are all privately owned. So, yeah, maybe we need to have that debate. I mean, I say this as a Kiwi Bank customer, but I'm a customer of three other banks as well. So I'm a firm believer in making sure that my eggs are spread around different nests, so to speak. So that I'm not reliant on one.
They're all still banks, though, Cam.
Well, that's right, and banks always
get some gold stashed under the bed somewhere.
Yeah, they're like
everyone. Go rob Paul, because clearly he does.
go and shake the gold out of the mattress, eh, Paul?
Yeah,
gold and silver.
Point about the history of the Bank of New Zealand, that's why it's important to have the debate. Yes, certainly what happened in 1984, but there were a whole lot of other factors in terms of the New Zealand economy and what was happening. And there's also a debate, I must tell you, I don't think we've got time for it here, but I was closely involved with it, in whether or not the move on the Bank of New Zealand was also a clever move by a number of people who became quite rich at being the consultants for privatising it. But it played an extremely important role in the development of New Zealand as an economy. And similarly across the Tasman with the Commonwealth Bank of Australia, which was a big player in the development of the Australian economy. Times move on, there's different developments that are needed. But the GFC showed us that private banks, huge private banks, and you alluded to it, Cam, too big to fail, were stepped in. So it's not just public banks that can get into trouble. It's those, safe as the Bank of England is no longer, I think, used as a term when the Royal Bank of Scotland went down, or one of the, forget now which ones in Britain went down, there were quite a number of them.
The Bank of Scotland, right.
And so that's where the debate comes in with a lot of discussion. Can I say here, too, that in such an important issue, because I'm talking, in my terms, I'm talking of a toolbox, and I think it's an important tool for any government to have in their toolbox, if I can make it clear. But it would be wonderful on this question, because it took us years to get the Kiwi Bank, and for those of us involved in it, if the Parliament... I would like to even see someone like a Don Brash in the Parliament, who might be for, I don't know what Don's position is on the private bank, But with his background, getting up and saying, well, here's some arguments for a public bank. I don't agree with them, but let's have a look at them, or whatever. It would be wonderful if the Parliament holds a mature debate, allows people to turn into it and say, okay, we've all got strong opinions, but we're going to give you the whole works. I don't think it'll happen at the moment, the way they do things.
Has it actually been used in the way, you know, that toolbox way, though, Matt? Or is it just another brand competing with the other retail banks?
The Kiwi Bank at the moment?
Yeah.
No, it's under, Cam's right, it's totally under capital. It was a setup. But yep. You see, that wasn't our plan. My own plan fell apart, so we had to depart the scene. But first of all, it was just an enormous fight to actually get the idea that you could have a publicly owned bank. Because the Labour Party, we were 14, four of us, 14 of them, and they told us to go and take a running jump. They said there's no place for public banks anymore. That was the
I wonder if an elegant solution for the situation with Kiwi Bank would be to take it into the fold of the superannuation, you know, the so-called Cullen Fund. There's huge capital there. And then they have their own bank as well.
I don't think the problem I have with... Oh, sorry, we're talking about everybody having a say, and
no, I'm listening. I'm very interested in this. It's
my problem with that. It'd be quite good if Cam and I get into Parliament. We could be on either side and talk about
interesting combo,
but bring out the issues. But with the Kiwi Bank and capitalisation, I'm not an expert in it, but I'd call in a lot of the banking, the whole way of raising capital. But there are these things. One is that if you turn it over to the Cullen Fund and if you turn it over to the ACC and they're on the board, they have their own agenda too. And here I think if it's a tool and in the public interest, that's why I say I want the government to run it. I want the government to run it because they've got their own agenda too on the ACC. They've got people from all these different groups and they've got the and New Zealand Post had the same problem. And they pull out, they don't want to do this, they want to do that. The government's got to be able to say, we want to do this, and open it to scrutiny, of course, but we want to do this and then go ahead and do it. But the raising of capital in a small country like New Zealand, yes, needs to look further than just New Zealand. But there's one area that the government hasn't raised capital, that is Westpac has got a lovely little doddle doing all the banking for all of the government. So
I've always wondered about that. Shouldn't the government-owned bank be doing that?
They're actually in the long run, they're owned by Australia. They're huge profit. I've got family who work for them, so I'll be careful. They like their job there, but they take their money to Australia anyway, the majority of it. But yeah, so there's that aspect of it, and then there are priorities. And here I'll throw something else in. I know Cam of old, I don't think he might like this, but look, there's a bank in China and it's owned by the BRICS and it's a development bank and they're lending money and left, right and centre. Now, people on the right say that's no good because that's the Chinese, well, not just the Chinese because it's owned by all of the BRICS and it's been joined. The BRICS have been joined by a lot of other countries. But they're loaning money and they're loaning money to some of the developing countries that are setting up state banks. And they're giving long-term loans. That may not be the best place to source a loan, but there's one other place where you can...
Should we just join BRICS?
Why?
Should we just join BRICS?
I think it should be looked at, personally.
The Kiwi Bank's woke, though. Chenille Lal, Susie Wiles, New Zealanders of the
That's
Year.
That's all on the, like...
That's not Kiwi Bank.
No. So the thing about these organisations,
they're just the sponsor.
Yeah, but even sponsoring it, sorry.
The thing about these companies is that the wokesters hold key positions in the marketing department and the HR department. And that's how they appear to have so much control because they can bully you into thinking you'll lose your job and they can project rainbows on everything. It's always interesting for me to kind of try and figure out how woke an organisation is actually once you kind of push those key roles out of the way.
Okay. So not much there, really?
No.
Okay.
But I'm not sure you should be considering joining BRICS. I mean, you've got...
Well, I knew you wouldn't like that.
Well, no, we've got... you've got Brazil. Okay, that
I love Brazil. Great country.
Yeah, Russia.
Yeah, not too bad.
My partner would agree.
Yeah, of course.
China.
Russia's doing great.
Yeah, these are great democratic.
China's doing great.
Yeah.
It's us that are suffering.
Well, I don't know. That's my two cents on BRICS.
Yeah, all right.
But tell you what, Cam, it would be useful. I mean, look, there's criticism. There is all sorts of views on the BRICS. And there's but we don't even have it in New Zealand. We should at least join the debate around the world. We should have our politicians saying, well, at least we know what's going on, reading it, thinking about it, and come out against it. But usually it's just a knee-jerk thing. We don't like
it. Yeah, it's just reflex. Like
without analyzing.
I agree with you. Yeah, and I was a prime example of someone who would knee-jerk on a particular thing because, you know, I didn't particularly like the politician that was pushing that agenda or whatever. But you're right, Matt, we do need to have a debate. We do need to have media as well that are prepared to have the debate rather than what they do currently, and they take sides themselves.
What about the politicians knowing what they're talking about?
That would be a good idea.
That would be helpful. Across many things.
The problem is politicians don't know anything about anything very much, even ministers. And I say this to people all the time when they write to me on the radio show and they say, well, why hasn't this minister done that? Well, they don't know. They ask the same people that were employed by the previous government for advice and then do the same thing.
Yeah,
and
fire them all. Fire
around
them all.
By them.
Yeah. So,
every change of admin. Yeah.
The more you know about politicians, the less you want them to make decisions.
To be honest, the more I experience politics, the more I loathe the public service. I don't know if it's like this in every country, but the whole idea of neutrality and serving the government of the day is an absolute lie. They bully and manipulate and push ministers into accepting their program of work, which, as you say, is unchanged from the last government. And it's only the very best ministers who are able to withstand that and tell them to get fucked. But then the media comes, sorry, I don't know if I'm allowed to say that on air, but then the media comes to their rescue and says, look at these poor public servants are being bullied by the minister. And so I think
these ministers need to grow some, really. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, why are you in the job? I mean, come on.
Well, that's really right. I totally agree with you. But what we've had in the last 6 years before this government was a bunch of ministers who were actually ninnies. Who thought that you could make a broad statement. I mean, the classic is Phil Twyford. You know, all of you.
Let it be done.
Like, line up all of his grandiose statements about Kiwi Build, right? Mm. And it maps that with reality. And you realize there's a minister who thinks that he actually has levers that he pulls. I mean, because you listen to them, the jargon they talk, these are levers that we can pull to make this happen. Well, pull them then.
Yeah, but which lever is he pulling in the end?
Exactly. Nothing happened because
pull the other one.
They didn't have the skill set to say to the civil servants who were busily undermining them, make this happen or else. And it's the or else part that nobody ever follows up on.
Mm.
All right, I think we should move on. Cam, for you, shifting goalposts, maths assessment, Labor says. Yeah, we don't do too well in this, do we?
Nobody comes out of this looking good. On the weekend, National announced that they were going to take some action, and in particular in the maths curriculum area, because they say that 22% of Year 8, which is Form 2 in old school, but 22% of, Year 8 students only are meeting the standard, or in the parlance that we used to use when we were brought up, passing. Everybody else is failing. But the opposition wasn't happy with that number. They said, this is terrible, this is misusing statistics, and the real number is actually 42% are meeting the standard.
Oh, that's all right then.
Without even realising that when they say that, 58% are still failing under a system that they did nothing about, whilst telling us at every drop of the hat in conjunction with the teacher unions, that we have a world-class education system.
No.
Well, even if you use the most generous understanding of statistics from the Labor Party, it shows that we're actually failing in simple things like maths. Mm. And that is an absolute indictment on our society that we've let this happen, on successive governments.
Who has let this happen? Let it happen?
Let's go back a bit, right? We were told that by David Lange that he was going to do a shake-up in the education system, that it was needed, I think, pretty much.
Tomorrow's schools, right?
And pretty much most of us agreed with that. There was something wrong in education. Well, here we are 30-odd years later, and the statistics have got worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. So we're at the point now where Form 2 or Year 8 students, only 22% of them meet the standards. And our standards are so weak anyway that if you compare our students with overseas students, like from Singapore, for example, we just get a hiding. Because we've got such low standards. Now, the only thing that's constant in all of that time are the teachers and the teacher unions.
But
everything else has changed. We've had different governments. We've had different policy settings. We've had different curriculum. We've had NCEA. We've had national standards. We've had all these things that change. But the one thing that's constant in all of that time, as our standards have been dropping and falling and collapsing, are the teacher unions and their intransigence, and their insistence that we've got a world-class education system. And someone needs to call them out and say, you're wrong, and you're still wrong, and anything you say now is, we're not going to listen to you anymore because you've had 30-odd years of making the system work, and you failed.
Yeah.
That makes me angry.
I can hear it. Matt?
I'm not so pessimistic about the New Zealand system. And look, I'm somebody who's been educated a long time ago in the formal school system in both Australia and here. I was actually quite impressed when I came as a teenager to New Zealand.
Long time ago, Matt. Well, maybe not that long ago, but
when you learnt mathematics, Matt, I bet you still know your 12 times table, your 11 times table.
Yeah, absolutely.
Table, right?
You learnt long division.
Yeah, long division, that sort of stuff. But look, don't put up a quadratic equation. I've forgotten what they are. But the thing is that, just to back on the New Zealand system, is that the fact that you had a public education system allowed so many people who, if it wasn't for that, wouldn't have come through. I wouldn't have come into, my parents were just ordinary workers. They appreciated the fact that what they didn't have, because they didn't get beyond primary school, was the key was the public education system. So the first thing is I'm an advocate of the public education system. Then I go to the questions of, okay, you've raised a whole range of areas of failure, what it might be. And I'm not for the simplistic, I think it's a simplistic argument, that it's just that the teachers' union don't have the best interests or be able to add expertise. Schools have got, across New Zealand, have got dedicated teachers. They've got teachers who other students will tell you that they pass because of that teacher. Now, what that tells me is that whatever the fix is, that teachers are obviously so important, the quality of the teacher. So
the training, it's the training.
That's my thinking, is that all of our teachers are funneled through a very specific training program, if you will. We're not a massive country where they can choose lots of different schools to go to or anything like that. And our education system for teachers is highly lobbied and highly ideological in terms of what is prioritised in teaching the teachers. And so they come out of there thinking that it is far more important that they know all the different pronouns that they could possibly call the children than it is to teach long division. So I think if we sorted out the school, we sort out the future. However, the unions and the teachers have so much kind of power and influence in that sphere as well.
everyone's too scared to take them on. But there's another critical era that's here. And you know, Matt, you touched on it. The problem we have also is that you're not going to do well at school if you don't go to school. Right? So we've got a failing in parenting and a failing in society. It's a societal failing where certain groups of people aren't sending their kids to school. We implemented school lunches on the basis that, well, we need to get kids to go to school, and so if we provide them with a lunch, then they'll get lunch and then they'll come to school. Well, that's not working.
Was that really sold on that basis? I thought it was just to provide good nutrition so the little brains would work all right while they were there.
Well, it was never particularly good nutrition, I don't think. I think it did the trick.
Right? But that was sold on
rather
that.
Rather than to lure them in, you know.
And these kids are in homes where they're poor and they've got no money for food, so they don't send their kids to school because then they're embarrassed by not having food. Well, okay, well, we'll supply lunches. And some schools supply breakfasts. But we've still got a mass, wagging issue where there's no consequences for any of it.
How the hell do you fix that, though? I mean,
well,
if it's that big.
I think it comes back to one of my pet issues, which is, and it's always kind of funny how it sits with my feminism, but I think that one of the major failings of our society is that we can no longer have one-income families. Now, whether or not that's the mother or the father, I don't give a flying rat.
I think you're onto something. I think you're onto something.
But when we could have one parent earning, one parent running the home, whichever way around, there was more oversight of children going to school and more hands-on rearing of the children. And so I think there's so many issues that come from, I guess, you know, the destruction of the nuclear family. And I say this as a lesbian in a long-term relationship. I think that that the kind of solid structure of parents and children where you can survive and have a roof over your head if one parent works provided a much stronger basis for children to have healthy and safe lives.
Well, I don't agree with that because here I stand, farmed out both of our children, and I think they're wonderful, my boys.
And I was raised by a single dad, so it's not that I think it cannot be done. My dad is marvellous. But I think on a societal level, when you've got all this pressure and all of these parents all having to work, so no one's there to boot them out the door in the morning to get on the bus, it does change how the family operates and how children are raised. I think people should have the choice. That's what my argument is.
It is a massive societal issue. Until we address that, getting kids to school, you can have the best curriculum in the world, but if they don't go to school, they're not going to get the lessons, you know. And one of my buddies last night on the show, Paul, he's on a board of a couple of schools, and he said that is the single biggest issue, is getting kids to come to school.
I just can't know how that can be fixed unless you drag them in.
Well, you know, what do we apparently still have truancy officers. What the hell do they do? It doesn't seem like they're dragging kids to school or penalizing parents.
Well, they're doing the low-hanging fruit.
There are people that are hard nuts and you'll never get any changes. There is low-hanging fruit. There's the people that if you actually do follow them up and actually have stern words, then they might actually show their kids to school.
I'm trying to be polite because I think there's a lot of issues that come into the schooling that we'd have to go and discuss, and we might have different views, but it'd be worth discussing them as to what feeds into the problems of schools. But I just use an analogy because, you know, I was the Minister of Prisons. And I used to get flack all the time because all I was trying to point out was that in prisons you largely had your social problems. I was never saying that excused anybody beating the hell out of anybody or killing them or whatever. I just said that you've also, when you look at a prison, you've got to look at your social problems. And I think the fact of the child abuse study 200,000 New Zealanders when we all so smug of saying New Zealand's a great country to bring up your children. Even I should say, but a great country to bring up your children. Mm. But 200,000 children over a period of time wasn't a great place for them at all. So a lot of those.
Still not with you know, every 5 weeks, babies getting killed.
Babies getting killed, they end up in prison. And you've just got to go into a New Zealand prison and look at the stories, and it's the same old cycle. So whatever the solutions were, you still had to discuss how they ended up in there. Now, in the schools, you've got pretty much a similar thing. Let me give you a little story. I went and was asked to, well, I taught one time, you know, our kids in Aotearoa, and the nine-year-olds reading level for 13-year-olds, that was a problem. They had a nine-year-old, even they were in the secondary system, they couldn't read at the level. So it was a problem. You have that problem. A friend of mine asked me to come to his class, 11-year-old, what do you call it, intermediate New Zealand, and they were at St. Kentigan's. You know the school, St. Kentigan's? I couldn't believe. I love my kids. I didn't have any discipline problems. I was struggling. But when I went to the school, I was a member of Parliament at the time, these 11-year-olds were like 14 or 15-year-olds. Their reading level was so high. They were sort of highly disciplined and self-disciplined. They all had little laptops. They were all extremely polite, which was nice. But the difference was, there was a class difference. These kids
and resources.
They had wonderful resources there. They came from the other thing is, just because someone comes from a middle class or up doesn't mean there's not awful problems at home. Dad drinks, mum does this. I know that. But still, generally speaking, they come into the school system. So you do have to discuss the fact that a lot of the failure occurs, that the issues coming outside of society, including income. Take Finland. The teachers there are highly paid. I live in the Netherlands. Teachers, I was surprised at their conditions. They only went to school when they had classes. They had all this time off for preparation and stuff. They were reasonably highly paid. They probably don't think, I don't know what it's like now. And you know, it was different. It was different from New Zealand. So looking at how the teachers were looked after, and the investment in education at all levels was, that was 30 years ago, so it might have declined. I don't know.
When you were the Minister of Corrections, did you get statistics on literacy of...
Yes, I did.
Imagine that most people in prison are functionally illiterate.
Functionally illiterate. You've hit upon it. Functionally illiterate. And if you went out, one thing that struck me was one person who wrote on this problem said, next time you're on an aeroplane, look, and this is in the United States, where they had a problem of about 30% in the country of illiteracy, functionally illiteracy, it might have been higher. He said, look out the window. There's a good chance that the mechanic doesn't understand the manual fictional engine. I didn't want to do that.
Oh, that can't be right.
But well, Boeing might tell you differently.
Recent times.
Yes, where does this thing go? Oh, it's the wing. Yeah,
In the prison, functional literacy, and there's some people who've addressed this, and there's some wonderful programs have coming. I try to tackle this problem. It's huge, though. It's huge.
And the problem with New Zealand is do you first address the illiteracy, or do you do all the drug and alcohol programs that are actually desperately needed as well?
It sounds too hard to me. I'm sorry.
Yeah. You said, 200,000 people in care were abused, right? And it's a large number, and there are some questions over that number, but let's just use the 200,000. This year eight issue, that's just one cohort of kids at school. It's 50,000.
Yeah.
Now, it won't be just year eight. It'll also be year 7, 6, 5, 4, and there'll be 50,000 in each of those, which easily beats that 200,000. And this is ongoing and will become a generational issue that we will be putting in prison in 30 years' time.
Not everyone who can't read will go to prison, though.
No, but if
a lot of people get by quite happily.
Right, and you can't do maths, it's very hard to hold down a job.
I guess.
Yeah. Very easy to go stealing.
All right, we're burning up time. Annie, for you, Chris Hipkins' political radar way off with petty, outdated questions, says Audrey Young.
I think Audrey's absolutely right. I watched him in the House yesterday, and I was actually quite floored by how poor his strategy was. I'm definitely getting the vibe that he's at least partially checked out. Like, he's not quite got the mojo, the drive.
Is he on the way out?
Well, yeah, I mean, everyone likes to poke fun and say, you know, Kieran's the next cab off the rank kind of thing. But I do think he doesn't want to let go of, he's not ready to let go of Parliament and the position and stuff, but he's just not got the same energy, the same kind of sharpness. I just feel like a couple of years ago, he would never have put up the questions that he put up.
Danny, I think he's checked out.
Yeah, he's relatively intelligent. You know, there's variations in Parliament. I'm sure you know, Matt.
Upper Hutt's finest.
And but he is an intelligent guy. I'm not his biggest fan personally, but he's intelligent enough that he can usually spin a good yarn in the House. Yesterday, I couldn't understand. I was like, who wrote these questions? Who thought this was a good idea? And the government got wins on the board by simply putting up Patsy Supps saying, what is it that New Zealanders want the government to be focused on and what Parliament to be focused on? Because they were so off base with their questioning. They were just, what it was is he ran a series of questions where he picked a different minister's gaffe or a different minister's, I guess, personal failing, and kind of asked the Prime Minister, is this up to your expectations? Now, that would be fine if it was, you know, related to their performance as a minister and stuff. You could see how that would be a good, you know, bit of questioning. But this was like about, you know, the badge versus sticker situation with Acton, the Māori Party, Todd. It was stuff that had been resolved. So what we were talking about before about Todd saying, you're not in Mexico, he raised that as one of his subs, saying, you know, is this acceptable, blah, blah, blah. And Luxon kind of went, well, we dealt with that already. He withdrew and apologised, and we've had that conversation last week. I having worked in opposition and as a staffer, I was sitting there going, where in the process did someone not say this is an appalling strategy to go into the House and pursue this? Because it shows a team that is completely lost.
Well, I congratulate you for watching Parliament.
I have to as part of my job, but it's
I don't know anybody else. You really are a beggar for punishment. Looking at it, yeah, Chris is on the way out. The knives are out for him.
Oh, really? Okay.
And they want another leader. The problem is, and it'll come, I think, the problem is that all I think the Labour Party is doing is looking for the charismatic leader. Now, I'm all for charisma, but you can have a charismatic, you can have Hitler. You know?
Do they have any?
If that's all you're looking for.
That's why they're looking at Kieran, but you're right. He doesn't have the substance to back that up.
You've got to have the I look for. I'd rather talk to a boring person who gives me substance than a flamboyant person who's going to run the country like a lungy and just give you fluff. Oh, that's all
I reckon Barbara Edmonds is their shining star, but she's not got enough experience in front of camera, kind of like she's just been brought to the front bench. But I think she's got the substance. I don't know how she goes with the charisma.
She's in the wrong group.
Look, and the New Zealand Parliament, this will please you, Cam. I went to Cuba, a place I like to go. So I really would get onto this program. And I talked with the Speaker of the House. Yes, they have a Speaker of the House. I took up with him. I said, well, the one problem you have in any Western country, I said to him, is that you have the Communist Party of Cuba in power. He said, okay. And we went through that. He said, but I've been to your parliament. Actually, he thought I was from the UK parliament. Or, you know, the House had been to your, I think your House of Commons. I said, well, it's not actually mine, but anyway. Yeah. All they do is abuse their ministers. And they shout and they scream. And he said, our Minister of Education, and I'd met the Minister of Education, Higher Education, he said every member of the Parliament and the people who come there and are on the commissions, the Minister of Education tries to get the most, he tries to get as much out of the budget. They work with him to get the best result. And now, look, people have their different views on what that happened, but I thought, it shut me up, actually. I thought of the New Zealand Parliament, and I thought quite often all people excel in, and the others clap and cheer when you get a smart
gotcha. Right on the board.
I've got nothing to do.
That's what Hipkins was going for yesterday. You could see him chasing the gotchas and failing over and over. It was really embarrassing, almost as embarrassing as Deborah Russell questioning Penny Simmons on Te Pūkenga and not understanding the finances. It was like 5 minutes that I felt like I wanted to crawl out of my own skin. I was so embarrassed secondhand.
You started as a brilliant possibility for being a finance minister. She is. Labour talks her up like she's a financial genius, you know.
Honestly, I've posted the question on my Twitter. Go have a look. It is so painful. I wanted to claw myself out of my skin.
Oh, God. That painful.
A lot of people do forget that Parliament's about theatre.
Yeah.
You know, you should be, if you're in opposition, you should be constructing a set of questions that aren't necessarily gotchas. They might be a gotcha in 3 weeks' time. But you're setting up a framework. It's like a test batsman, right? He's got to get through the fast bowlers. He's got to, you know, get his eye in. Every loose ball that he can go, he tries to hit to the boundary.
Watch out for the sledging.
Yeah, watch out for the sledging, right? It's all designed to
do a bit of sledging of your own.
And that's the thing with you know, a lot of people said, oh, why did Todd McClay apologise for that statement?
And they don't
actually understand how the game works.
Yeah.
Game, right? You say something outrageous, you get a reaction, someone says, I object. The speaker then says, please stand, withdraw and apologise. They stand up, they go, I withdraw and apologise. It's all part of the game.
They say something else.
It's still got said and it's still in Hankard. And they do it for effect.
Yeah. Even
if you apologize. Trevor Mallard did it to Don Brash. You know?
I just want them to do the work right. I have no interest in the entertainment. I'm sure I'm speaking for many people. Oh, that's right, like, Matt. That's what you're saying.
Don't watch Question Time if that's how you feel, because
I never do.
Not where the work is done. The work is not done in Question Time. The work is done in select committees.
Yeah.
Oh, but a good question, the point we're making, a good question to a minister can put them on the spot, but it needs to be a good question, not a ha-ha, watch you, for the benefit of the public.
The best ever I've seen of somebody questioning someone and really drilling down and really making the minister squirm was Lockwood Smith when he was effectively prosecuting Tito Phillip Field by asking questions of Helen Clark that made her squirm. And that's the only time I've ever seen Helen Clark squirm in the House, and she was blue in the House.
Philip Field was answering the questions and he was...
They were about Philip Field.
Oh, about him.
Right. Okay. He was asking them of the Prime Minister about Philip Field. And it really, like, she was like kind of, you know, trying to protect him because he's part of the Labour caucus. But she was unable to. And it was only when he said, oh, if you move against me, I'll leave the Labour Party, that they threw him out. And then it was everyone had knives into him, including Helen Clark.
Call your bluff.
But watching Lockwood Smith using really precise questions over a period of weeks to debilitate a minister via his boss was just brilliant. And people should really try and go back and have a look at those, or at least look at the questioning, because that's how you get a minister. It's hard, it takes time, but the results are effective.
Why aren't you doing it, Cam? You should be in there.
I'd rather poke pins in my eyes than be in Parliament.
Okay. Look, we're right up against time. A few comments on New Plymouth councillor Murray Chong's car hit by gunshot. What do you make of this?
How awful.
It was a slug gun, not a regular gun.
Yes, but if you read the totality of the things that have been done to this poor guy, and also if you remember that what he's advocated for in this case, which is to end Māori wards, you know, we can have different opinions on that. However, polling shows that the majority of New Zealanders agree with him on this, including a majority of Te Pāti Māori voters. So when he's advocating for this, extremists are doing this to him, and then the media's reporting as if deserves it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
no one deserves violence for having an opinion.
No.
The like noses. You know,
in the past, you know, my past life, I might not have agreed very much with what Matt had to say. Very often. Perhaps now.
Matt looks surprised.
I wouldn't have that shotgun at my house, I wouldn't know.
Well, you've got problems. But, okay. But these days, you know, I've learned the benefit of debate. I've learned the benefit of listening to other people that they may, you know, in rare occasions, sometimes have something that's useful to say.
Remember that saying, it's be kind to people on the way up because you'll meet them on the way down?
Yeah, totally, yeah.
This is true. Yeah, I think we've got a real problem in terms of the national conversation around race, and this is just one example of it. I think that Te Pāti Māori is being deliberately inflammatory.
Race-based.
And leadership from other political parties needs to stand up and grow a, you know what, because if Labour and Greens keep indulging them,
and National,
it's just not going to be good for any of us. We need to be able to function with different opinions on race and also knowing we're multicultural, and we need to be able to do this without someone being threatened that they're going to get king hit and end up in hospital, like Murray Chong, you know?
Yeah. All right, I think we're done for this Friday morning. Thank you, Annie O'Brien, for being on our panel.
It's lovely to be back.
Matt Robson, great to have you here as well.
Thank you.
And, oh dear.
He always laughs when you do that.
Thank you, Cam.
Tanaka Vakalevu.
Tanaka.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.